history pretty much as written by George Kostikowski in the Festschrift issue of the Journal of Physical Chemistry, but I wanted to fill in some of the details, particularly about your family. Your father was a lawyer from Gallatin, Tennessee, is that right?
He was not born in Gallatin, but he just got out there. He was a lawyer, practiced in New York, ultimately.
In New York City?
Yes.
But that was before you were born? Or?
While I was young.
I see, but... Where did he get his law degree?
Well, he studied with an uncle in Tennessee. He was a judge, lawyer. And that was the main those days, you saw the third apprenticeship.
I see. And your mother, did she have formal education beyond high school? Or?
No, not really. She educated. She was brought up in Gallatin, Tennessee, and she went to the local school. I don't know about, but not beyond high school level.
Now, when you were growing up, then your father was practicing corporate law or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, that's right, in New York City, and see, we. First, we lived in New York for a few years. My father and my mother lived there first. And I had an older sister. She was... And I was born in Tennessee because my mother's brothers and her mother lived in Gallatin. And one of her brothers is a doctor. And so she went back to Tennessee to have a baby, you see. Myself and my older sister Sue also.
Was your father active in politics after he left Tennessee?
I don't think he was active. He certainly was not active in any very formal sense after he left Tennessee. He did have a political career in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Before he was married, before he moved to New York. In fact, he was a member of the state legislature, Tennessee, and I think for two terms. And second term, he was the Speaker of the House of Legislature, which had its queer feature because he was the... in the succession for becoming governor, if the governor were to die. I don't remember which level it was, but he was too young to be governor. There's a restriction on age was in Tennessee, so he couldn't be governor, but fortunately the necessary number of people didn't die, leaving the dilemma.
So was he, how old was he when he married your mother then, roughly?
He must have been around 25, but I'm not sure about
it. So he was a very young man for a legislator.
Oh, yes, he was very young.
Yeah. What were your education, where were you educated in your elementary grades? Grammar school and so on.
The grammar school was in Yonkers, New York, public school number 3, mm-hmm. which... We moved to Yonkers when I was about 4 or 5 years old, and when I planned to go to school, I went to the public school that was open, the district, and that was until through essentially first year high school. The school went through 8 or 9 grades. It had 1 year of high school for some of the children, and then I went from there to the Riverdale Country School in New York City, but on the edge of the border between New York and Yonkers,
Was this a boarding
private
school? Or
no,
a,
this was private school. It did have some boarding students, but I was not a boarding student.
Mm-hmm.
And that was for 1 year only, and then my parents sent me to Lawrenceville School in New Jersey, very near Princeton. And I took, I had 2 years there. So I was in high school 4 years, I was public school in Yonkers, Riverdale, and then 2 years of boarding school. I did board. That was that, and I went to Princeton from there.
How did your interest in science start?
Well, it started very early. In my early memories of playing with, not very serious scientifically, but playing with electric trains, but it, to an extent, which taught me a lot about electricity, and I really fool around with that sort of thing. And then chemistry sets was the next lead in. And my parents had absolutely no scientific education, either of them. And I owe them a great deal in that regard, because they, despite that, very much encouraged me in reading science and provided books and things for it.
Well, what kind of community was Yonkers, or where you lived then?
Well, it was a typical suburban commuter place. It was very nice, actually, at that time. We were on the edge of a forested, almost a forested area, you know, city blocks, but still. I remember deer running through the yard once or twice. It was sort of connected up with woods, of course, now totally built up. It's terrible to go by there. I avoid it like plague, because I went by once where the old house was and is, and all just jammed together houses, you know, and I think of all the space I had as a child and really lovely place. My father commuted about an hour every day to down Manhattan, a little train that they used to have there.
So your classmates, companions in school, so on, engage in more or less the same kind of things you did?
As far as, yes, I'd say so. Oh, it was more. Look, we were in a nice, fairly well-to-do neighborhood, and the public school had all kinds of people in it. I mean, it was a typical public school, and it wasn't, I mean, it had people from around my where I lived, and people from a wider, children from a wider range than that. So we had all kinds.
Did you get encouragement or in science from some of your teachers, or?
I would say that there was one of the teachers who was pretty encouraging. I don't remember particularly any of the others being. They weren't outstanding. It was supposed to be a good school, and it was a good school. But there weren't any frills, there wasn't anything fancy about it. There was only one teacher that I remember who was really encouraging. No, it's been discouraging.
Did you have chemistry or physics and laboratories?
Nothing. I had no science in this curriculum at all.
How about at Lawrence?
At Riverdale, they had some very good teachers. At least one of them in particular was quite encouraging. They had a science club, which this fellow sponsored, and his teacher. I joined that. So there I had full official encouragement. Lawrenceville. At Riverdale. Lawrenceville had a good chemistry teacher who was mainly interested in getting you through the college boards. His interest in chemistry seemed to be rather modest. He was, and just the year that I went there, they got a very young Harvard graduate as a physics teacher, who was mainly made fun of by the boys.
Do you remember his name?
I should, because it was, he was, I mean, he was some, his father was known. I can't remember, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
Okay, how did you come to go to Princeton?
My father had law partners, not actually partners, I believe, but had the people he knew, friends, in practice of law. One of them who went to Princeton and sort of influenced the family to send me there.
Was Lawrenceville School sort of viewed as a preparatory place for getting into Princeton? Or
very much so. Uh-huh. In those days, practically 95% of the class, I think, moved up to Princeton. Certainly a very major portion of the class. That changed in a few years. The headmaster at the time, Mr. Abbott, they call him Mr. It sounds funny to me because it's known as Bot by the students. But he was from Yale, and he tried hard to get some of them to go to Yale. And gradually, of course, with the changes in the admissions policy, no college would take 90% of the class anymore. Mm-hmm. Lawrenceville, you may not want to include this in your official marks, but I disliked it intensely.
I think that's all right. It's up to you. It's your interview. Why? Because of the boarding school atmosphere?
Well, it was a boarding school atmosphere. I didn't like the boys for the most part, although actually in retrospect, looking at what happened to them, most of them went to Princeton where I knew them again. There were all kinds in that crowd. But Abbott...
Would you like to continue with what you were saying about Abbott?
Well, I would say he was totally non-intellectual, which is, in my opinion, a typical private school headmaster. I once heard that there was a gathering of headmasters at Princeton down. And the Lawrenceville man and the Riverdale man were there, so I thought I should go and shake hands with them. Almost couldn't find them in the crowd. They were all so much alike, these back-slapping, healthy-looking, athletic characters. At any rate, I didn't like Abbott. I didn't like Lawrenceville. And it didn't help me intellectually.
Well, let's go on to Princeton then. Did you like Princeton?
Oh, Princeton was just a revelation to me. When I went there, you know, and I found other students who were interested in things. I don't care what the heck it was they were interested in, but they were interested in something intellectually. And I thought Princeton was just marvelous. Enormously enjoyed it.
Excuse me. Did you go to Princeton anticipating chemistry or science?
I started being interested in science when I was 6 years old, I would guess. And that continued intensely. But I had a strong deviation. For a while, when I was in high school, I got interested in engineering. And, you know, different kinds of engineering, electrical engineering, that made sense, but also construction and mechanical, you know, civil engineering, bridges and things. And my father got me a job just before I went to Princeton. working on a project digging one of the subway lines in New York. And I worked in the office of the contractor. He kept the time sheets, you know. It wasn't really a engineering experience for me, but fortunately it showed me that I didn't belong in that world, which is all too clear. But I did do that, and when I went to Princeton, I had finally decided just before going that what I would do would be to postpone the engineering part, take that later, start with basic science courses. Of course, I never went to the engineering. I got into chemistry right away and physics. So that as an undergraduate, I always took chemistry, physics, and math each year, then plus whatever was necessary in the way of other requirements distribution.
And so your major and your bachelor's was chemistry?
It was chemistry.
And were there minor subjects that you...
Well, you see, I took math and physics just equally, equal amount of them.
What was the chemistry curriculum like for you then?
Well, I enjoyed it, but there was one aspect of it that I really sincerely regret later on, and that was something that was quite universal in those days. Certainly had the same thing at Harvard when I got up here. That is an excessive laboratory demand on the students in analytic chemistry. And this rote learning of the... I can start out now on the qualitative analysis scheme, you know. Mercury, lead, and
chloride precipitation.
That's right.
I remember that,
and
too.
One of them is hot water takes the...
Yes.
Dissolves one of the things out, and I don't know.
But that was qualitative.
That was qualitative.
Yeah, right.
Analysis scheme. But then we had quantitative analysis, hours and hours and hours of it. And I was terrible in that. But when I was a freshman, I was an eager beaver, there's no question about that. But I mean, I went to all the colloquia, I didn't understand a damn thing, but I'd go to the organic colloquia, the physical colloquia, chemistry, and then in physics. Physics, of course, was just having this terrific revolution, the development of quantum mechanics going on in full blast while I was a freshman who were knowing and knowing nothing about it, except I went to these colloquia, but I didn't understand anything. But what I started to say was that as a freshman, there's one thing I should add on the Lawrenceville part, kind of disorderly, but I did found the science club at Lawrenceville, which is not exactly what's going to be on a bronze plaque, but it's still going, I think. And one of the things that happened is that somebody knew Professor Furman at Princeton, who was the analytical chemist, and arranged for him to come down and talk to us. Lawrence was very close, and he gave a nice talk and interested me. So when I was next year a freshman, I went and asked him if I could do some research with him. If any way I could do research. Well, he said, I didn't know how to weigh anything. I didn't know how to work a burette. I never heard of a burette. And I certainly wasn't prepared to do research in any sense of the word. But he was a great man to my book. And he thought about it all, and he said, okay, fine. And he gave me a problem. Now, the problem he'd been working on was the use of tungsten electrode, tungsten wire electrode, together with the usual other electrodes, you know, use, as an oxidation reduction endpoint indicator. And you plot the voltage, EMF, and at the end point of the oxidation.
Were the other, are you using calomel electrodes?
Calomel electrodes. Like that.
At that time.
The other end is the reference electrode. Well, he showed me how to run the titration and write these things down, which I did. Then one day I thought about it, and I went to talk to him. I said, you know, I don't understand why you have this elaborate business with the potentiometer and galvanometer, you know, for getting this voltage, EMF reading. Why don't you just put the tungsten and platinum wires? We had a platinum electrode, one of the things there. And run it through the galvanometer. With potentiometer, with galvanometer in there. And he very patiently explained to me about the reversible electrodes, and you shouldn't draw a finite current, and so balance out all the rest of the rationale for it. But nevertheless, we put the tungsten wire and platinum wire into the solution and through the galvanometer, and really, for an endpoint purpose, it worked just fine. And Fermin, he talked about patenting it, and Fermin talked to a friend who knew about patents, and they, I guess, actually sent in an application, but quickly got discouraged when, you know, we knew nothing about patents, and the idea that people string out the time it takes to get a patent deliberately, didn't understand those things. And we got objection, we got things back from the patent office, you know, the prior art claims. So we didn't fool with it, which of course we, was a sensible thing to do. But this led to a paper. That was my first research paper, German Chemical Society. And it came out the following year, I think, 1927. These.
Right, I have that.
So that was
But this was work you did while you were a freshman.
That's so right.
Good. Did that allow you to skip some of the lab courses? No.
Well, that's why I started to tell you about that. It's because I started on analytical chemistry. The freshman year, I had Hugh Taylor. Actually, the freshman course, they set up for that year, for a few years, a separate course with a small number of students in it, about 1,000, 2,000, like that. And Hugh Taylor, who was the chairman of the department at the time, big man, place, he gave it. I didn't learn any chemistry in that course, but it was very important to me, because Hugh Taylor's make things so exciting that you just couldn't resist getting taken by it.
But Hugh Taylor was a physical chemist.
He was a physical chemist. And,
but he was teaching a general chemistry course?
Well, this small special course. They had a regular course with, I suppose, maybe 50 or 100 students in it. And then they had this one that just had about, I think it was less than probably a dozen.
Did you mean you didn't learn any descriptive chemistry? Or what?
I didn't learn in that course any chemistry. Well, I'm exaggerating, of course. But because what would happen would be this. We'd get in there, we'd assemble in the classroom, and then finally you would arrive with first thing he did is get out his pipe, place it in his chalk tray at a convenient place, and then he would open the book, which is Miller's little book, and rather fat book, but chemistry.
Oh, Miller's Inorganic Chemistry?
Not the big one, but the little one.
This is what I see.
And he would open this and let's see, now we were talking about sodium chloride, I believe, and so on. But he never got much more beyond that in the topics that he was supposed to be teaching today. Because he would start telling us about the research results they got yesterday or last night, how exciting they were. And I exaggerate a bit. Come in. He was a very exciting teacher.
Who are the other professors that influenced you particularly?
They were important also. Is that gonna...
We can pause.
Let me say that in the spring of my freshman year, Peter DeBye came to America to give lectures. He gave a lecture to the Electrochemical Society in Philadelphia. And the chemists, many of the chemists at Princeton, went down to hear him. And they took me along. And there was Furman and Taylor and Charlie Smythe, I think. Oh, sure it was. And there's a... No, my memory is bad.
We can skip it, put it in
I
later.
Remember, yeah, I can... teacher of physical chemistry. You'll have to put up with a number of lapses on my part, I'm afraid.
That's quite all right.
But they took me down to Furman. Furman's car, and I remember Furman was a very conservative, cautious fellow. Fine man. But he carried two spare tires in his car, which I thought illustrated his reputation. So they took me down there, and I heard my talk. And that was a very nice occasion. I appreciate it, because it helped me get to know more members of the faculty. I didn't take courses with all of them. But going back, I'm never going to get beyond that analytical chemistry if I don't get moving. Furman taught the quantitative analysis. And one of the climax experiments was complete analysis of some kind of Arthur Clay's feldspar, which was terrible because getting it into some kind of solution was quite an operation. It was something. And I did very poorly on that. I mean, my results were very bad. And four of the grades were announced by Furman. Said, you know, I'm sorry about this, but I just can't give you more than a B plus, A minus. Clearly, it wasn't an A. And I was so delighted because I thought I'd flunked the course. How many times I hadn't dumped my unknown on the desktop, picked it up with a sponge, squeezed it back into the test tube. Is a slight exaggeration, but not much. An ability as an analyst.
All right, continuing, from this experience, did you decide to become a theoretical chemist? Or?
No. I moved from Furman's operation to work with Charles Smythe. This would be, I guess, when I was a sophomore, maybe. And there are a couple of papers in there. My name is Smythe,
yes, the dielectric polarization of liquids and electric moment and motor structure.
They
I worked in the lab, in his laboratory. By the way, he's 90-something or other and going strong right now. I don't mean he's not doing any science work, I know.
Yeah.
So it appears there. And his brother just died at age 90, I think. Harry Smythe of Smythe Report. Well, no, I kept on doing experimental work, first with Smythe for a couple of years, then with Bill Richards. And then with Pauling a little bit. But it was pretty clear that I wasn't all that great in the laboratory. Well, it wasn't all that clear. I mean, I did all right in Princeton laboratory, except in quantitative analysis course. But I certainly... I don't consider myself a pure theoretician, incidentally. I think that what I do best is perhaps is think of experiments and then get somebody else to do them.
Did you like organic chemistry or ever consider?
No, I didn't like organic chemistry much.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me that it wasn't a very good course, I must say. It seemed to me we'd set up a still every time we went in the laboratory, and I'd figure out what it is we'd distill later when I had to write up the experiment. And I didn't get much out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, really it was a fairly limited course.
What, do you have any recollection of the text used?
No, I have no idea what that
was. What about the physical chemistry course?
The physical chemistry course was given by this man, his name is rattling around the wrong part of my brain at the moment. Not very well.
Was this before...
Jeff Webb. T.
Webb.
Jefferson Webb.
Mm-hmm. Was this... when did Hugh Taylor write his big treatise on physical chemistry?
It must have been about that time, because I have a copy of it, and I bought it when I was there. He probably came out in my junior year, thereabouts. But Webb was teaching the physical chemistry course. I took that during the second or third year.
Well, then, Taylor's book was not used as teaching text?
No.
Was it more a reference text?
It's a reference thing. It's very, very big detail. Two volumes. There was a student in the graduate school. I stayed a year in graduate school, basically. There was one chemist there who flunked the preliminary exams one time after another. And he realized he studied out of that big two-volume set. It was just inappropriate for that. You can't go through and really learn in detail that much material in any sense about what he's trying to do.
Now, Jeff Sturcio saw a senior thesis, or maybe it was a master's thesis title, on quantum chemistry,
right,
or quantum mechanics, that you wrote.
This was my senior year. We had a thesis requirement. In fact, a junior thesis and a senior thesis. The junior thesis wasn't much. It was sort of paraphrasing the Bias paper. I think it was on the frequency dependence, but I don't remember actually. It's on the dipole moment stuff, anyway. But it wasn't original at all. Well, it was supposed to be. My senior thesis, I worked with, I don't have this every time a name comes up. He was in the physics department. And,
You never published any of this outside with this?
The senior thesis appeared only as a Princeton thesis, mm-hmm. but it really was a little book on quantum mechanics. I have it around somewhere. I worked with this man. He was very helpful indeed.
Had he been to Europe, or what was his
well,
background
at that
in quantum
time,
chemistry, quantum theory?
I don't know where he picked up his knowledge of this. It was right. You see, I was a freshman in 1926, I guess it was. In the 1930s when I graduated from Princeton. So it was 29-30 that during the thesis. Well, Ed Condon came to Princeton just before that, I think when I was a junior perhaps. And I took his course in mechanics. He was busy at that time writing Condon and Morris. Phil Morris was there with him as a postdoctoral fellow, I think. And they were writing their book on quantum mechanics, which is really the first American textbook, I think.
Now, where was Condon at the time?
He was at Princeton. He'd come to Princeton.
He was on the faculty at Princeton.
He was on the faculty at Princeton. But he left after 1 year, went to Iowa, and then came back again the next year, mm-hmm. and then stayed for a while.
Now, was the course he taught classical mechanics, or was it...
He taught classical mechanics that first, that junior year, my junior year, I guess it was. And then 2 years later, at any rate, while I was there, he gave a course out of Dirac, or Dirac's book, which is a theory. I attended that, but that was rather much for me. But working on the senior thesis was close help from the professor. I put out a thesis, which certainly that thesis job helped me very much in dealing with our book later on, and with Pauling and Wilson. Now, I don't mean that it was anything original into the thesis at all, but it certainly helped me understand the subject.
Would there be a copy of that in the Princeton library, or would yours be the only?
I don't know. I have it around here somewhere. I dug it out a few years back. Somebody asked me about it. There's a physics study similar to this oral history business. Physics, you know about theirs.
The Physical Society, is American Physical Society, has done a much better job, or started much sooner in
they
the
started,
history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now they've got one of them talked to me about the quantum mechanics, never a full fledged interview like yours. But mm-hmm. and I dug it out at that time, and I think it's around here somewhere.
Now, what was your master's degree work and thesis?
Well, I didn't have any master's thesis, but I worked with Richards, William T. Richards, who was the son of T.W. Richards at Harvard. A very Harvard fellow. Very nice guy, very. And who had a particular friend named George Kistiakowsky down there. That's where I met George first. But Richards was a fine fellow, and he had ideas, and he was working with the velocity of sound, and I did something with him as a first-year graduate student. There's a paper there, actually. There's one paper sort of scraped up off the floor.
Yes.
It wasn't much of a... I didn't accomplish much there.
Velocity of sound and solutions of benzene and et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he was a physical chemist also.
He was a physical chemist, mm-hmm. right. And he did something special for me. It was fun. I don't know that it really had a big effect on my career, but Alfred Loomis was a investment person, Wall Street person, some kind of very wealthy man. And he had set up a laboratory in Tuxedo Park, New York. He got a house there. He bought a second house, and he converted half of it into a laboratory that had concrete floor. So he made a laboratory out of it. And the rest of the house he used as a living quarters for visiting scientists who worked in the laboratory. And it is a private, personal operation he had there, you see, financed with his own money. And it was rather fabulous. I went up there in one summer, maybe two summers, with Bill Richards, who had an entree and invited to work there. And one of the people who was there was some sort of a star person. Famous optical physicist, a grading.
Oh, Strong? Or before
no.
Strong? Wood.
Wood.
R.W. Wood, okay.
Yeah, and he had this fabulous collection of stories that he loved to tell. I admit he repeated himself eventually, but they were wonderful stories. And there were some other people there, I can't remember their names, and I don't know them anymore. There was an astronomer from Yale who was busy making calculations on planetary motions, I think, interactions. There was a man from Bell Labs who's sort of the originator of the crystal clock idea. Having quartz diesel electric. And Loomis got interested in clocks, and he ordered three of the best, very best pendulum clocks, Riffler clocks in the world, set them up on special concrete piers in the basement. And then he had this guy from Bell Labs that provided three crystal clocks. And then they kept records, and they had a radio to pick up time signals from all over the world. And then the astronomer from Yale, I think it was, analyzed this stuff. For example, they got the effect of the gravity on the Earth's tides, you see, pushing the clocks up and down daily, and could see this effect.
Was the effect measurable?
Yeah, they could measure it out, yeah. See, they had a year, two or three years of data for the Fourier series on it, and they pulled all these things out of it. I don't think anything very profound came out of it, I must say.
Was this before the radio frequency standards were broadcast from the National Bureau of Standards?
That's right,
and so on.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed, I think so.
Would have been...
I think so, I wouldn't be quite so sure. At any rate, the idea of the Grazer clock, that I think was this Bell Labs man, a little, not much earlier than that. Another fellow who was there was the Englishman, wrote a book on soap bubbles once. But he was more famous than that. Englishman. Sorry, that name's go away.
You can always insert it when we edit.
Yeah, if I think of it in the meantime.
Oh, you mentioned Wood. I think Kostyakovsky's.
He was there later. He went to Tuxedo Park himself later.
Oh, Kostyakovsky did.
Yeah,
he mentioned Wood, apparently missed the Raman effect. That was a story I'd not heard.
I can tell you about the Raman effect, because I was there when that happened. The Raman effect was discovered by Raman, was published by him in Nature, I believe. And a copy of Nature arrived at Tuxedo Park, and Wood saw it. And immediately went into the laboratory, I mean, probably within minutes, but anyway, within hours, into the laboratory and began a typical Wood improvisation. And he took a quartz crystal, he took a bucket and a rubber tube, he put the water in the bucket, and then he put dye in it to filter out one of the lines, mercury lamp, set up a mercury lamp, a quartz crystal, or a crystal, maybe it was quartz now, I don't know. He made a solid-state Raman with a crystal or something. And he verified the Raman effect within a day or two. and dashed off a note to nature, verification of the common effect. There's, you know, clothes been holding the pail, and everything like that is typical word improvisations of work.
So did you, your publications with Smythe originated from work there, or?
No, that was the work that I did at Princeton.
Mm-hmm. What in particular did you do with the tuxedo
I accomplished absolutely nothing. Richards was trying to do something on supercooled water, supercooled liquid, and I was incapable of contributing to that, frankly. I fooled around, or I don't remember the difficulty, but I got into some kind of a permanent difficulty, and Richards was not able to get me out of it. I mean, he couldn't fix it either, and that was a failure. It was all a failure. Wood stories stick with me.
Fine.
Boyce, is that right? Soap bubble man. I think it is Boys, but I'm not absolutely sure.
I can't just say myself. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me
one of the people weighed the earth fairly.
No, I was coming back to Princeton. You mentioned to me once that you had close relations with the Princeton faculty. In fact, that you sought them out and
I wasted a lot of their time. Freely.
Physics as well as chemistry or other subjects?
Well, physics, no. Not except my thesis advisor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't want to know. I had a freshman course in physics, a big course for all students, and the man who gave it was my memory of him, was an old man. Of course, he's probably a good many years younger than I am today. These things, well, at any rate, he just couldn't understand and couldn't accept not quantum mechanics, but quantum theory, the idea of quanta. And Gee was his name. And I went to him about research at the same time I went to Furman. And he turned me down very properly. But he explained that, well, you know, in physics you couldn't really do these things, so you had a lot more training, so on. And I didn't have close relationships, really, with. With Condon I did, with my thesis advisor I did, with Harry Smythe, who was a professor of physics, I did, and I took a special course on spectroscopy that he worked up just for me and for another student. Bill Preston, who became professor at Harvard later on, is retired now. He and I went to Smythe. We went because another professor gave a course in the catalog, but it said in the catalog, go see the professor before you signed up for the course. And he was out of town, and that year, and give the course, and somebody told me, well, it's too bad because he hasn't given that course in 5 years. He'd love to have somebody take it. But instead, Harry Smythe fixed up something special for us.
How large was Princeton then, undergraduate college?
I think my class had about 600 students in it, if I remember correctly, originally.
And how many would you have in chemistry?
Oh, it was very small. Chemistry had about six or eight concentrators. Physics was even smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were five concentrators or something like that. And it stayed, they both stayed small for a long time.
Speaking of spectroscopy, what was the state of the art when you took spectroscopy in Princeton?
Well, that was purely experimental. Actually, it wasn't all that much spectroscopy, as a matter of fact. I guess it was the other course that was spectroscopy that we wanted to take, and it wasn't given. And we had this laboratory course. So actually, we put together a little homemade mass spectrometer. And I can now speak learnedly to my colleagues who use them all over the place, you know, detectors and beams and so on. And they have troubles. They have the same troubles we had. The surfaces are corroded and the charges build up on them and deflect the beam. You can't focus it and so on.
This was, what kind of focusing did you use, or how did this operate?
Oh, well, you know, I don't remember the details, but I think it was
electronic acceleration.
You accelerated, yeah, you made the ions, you accelerated them in the field. Now, whether it was magnetic deflection or just electric, I think there was a magnet involved. I think there was, we had a magnet, a special. I think that part of it was sort of a little box for the field and a magnet.
How did you detect?
I don't remember what kind of a surface. I mean, the beam had hit something, but whether it was, whether it was a special material so that you.
Was there something like flame photometry, spectroscopy?
No, there was no flame involved.
Not thinking of other forms of spectroscopy.
Oh. Well, actually, we didn't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do spectroscopy. It was Henry Norris Russell was his name. He's the big astronomer that I had been. He gave the spectroscopy course. And then he wasn't giving it back here. He was abroad. So we took a quite different course.
His spectroscopy course would have been atomic spectroscopy,
atomic spectroscopy. In those days, every university had a physics department, had a big rolling circle, 21-foot grating, a big special room. Everybody had one of those things. Now there isn't. You wouldn't find one in the United States as a whole, I think. Physics went in, I think they tend to go in fads, the waves, they play much more so than physical chemists. There's one thing at a time is fashionable in physics.
Let's see. Well, were there any of your colleagues, fellow students at Princeton that you particularly remember or that you'd like to make comments about?
Well, one person who was quite a bit of help to me as an undergraduate, at least 2 years ahead of me, George Kimball, came across the chemistry in Columbia eventually.
You wrote the book on quantum chemistry?
That's right, with Henry Eyring.
Yes.
He became a student of Eyring's. But when I knew him, I was an undergraduate. He was 2 years ahead of me. As an undergraduate, and then he was there, and I knew him as a graduate student too. He's a very smart fellow, very smart fellow, very learned. I have a story about him that I like. It seems that people saw him in the chemistry laboratory. He spent a lot of time there. He was a chemist. And people had trouble finding certain professors at a certain hour. And they discovered that they were assembling, physical chemists were assembling in a laboratory in a room there. And they're learning quantum mechanics from George Kimball, who was a first-year graduate student, I guess, at that point. He hadn't written the book yet with Eyring. He was lecturing as a student to his own faculty there. He was a very not only a very clever and very learned and very intelligent, but he was a very good lecturer too. So I learned a lot from him, just asking him questions. I mentioned Bill Preston, who was... But, you know, in these chemistry and physics, little groups of four or five, there weren't all that many famous people, I'll tell you. They were not outstanding, mostly.
Well, just to mention the people you've mentioned, though, is impressive. Now, how did you come to go to Caltech?
That was very simple. First of all, Richards urged me to leave and go to Harvard. He wanted me to go to Harvard. Well, I didn't know anything about Harvard. I didn't know anything about Caltech. I've heard of Pauling. I talked to Taylor. He said, you go to Caltech and work with Pauling. So I did.
How was this arranged? Did you just apply formally, or did Taylor call Pauling
sure
or something?
I'm sure he called up Pauling or wrote to them or something.
Yeah.
And I was admitted.
Were you, it was established when you were going that you were going to work for Pauling? Or?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Which isn't a good idea in general, I'd say. We don't let our students do that, as you know. They can't sign up until they've had a year.
Yes.
Finding out who's here. It's right for them.
Now, how was your Princeton education financed? By the family?
Up until the stock market crash, my father was on paper, a wealthy man. And he paid for my Princeton education. 1929 came and he lost everything. I had a very hard time. So when I went out to Caltech, I had a teaching fellowship. In those days you could live on a teaching fellowship and go to school. It's become difficult to do because the price of tuition has gone up so much more than the rate of pay for these jobs. I don't think people can do that anymore. I'd say most of my colleagues my age lived on teaching fellowships and got their advanced degrees that way.
Let's pause now for a change of tape.
Here. Try to find one of these for you.
This was an after-dinner talk you
That's
gave
right,
where?
I wrote in Florida one of his annual chemistry.
For
quantum chemistry meetings.
Now, who was the...
Lovdien.
Lovdien?
L-O-W-D-I-N, I think.
Okay. Yes, we may want to see if we can a copy of that. Okay. Now, you're... How was the transition from Princeton to Caltech?
That worked very nicely. I arrived there in the summer, and I put up at the faculty, what they call the Athenaeum, which is a very elegant building, serves as a faculty club for Caltech, and for the Mount Wilson Observatory, and for the Huntington Library. We all use it for go to lunch there, lots of people, and we have rooms there. And I first had a room, but first of all, I couldn't afford a room. Secondly, I didn't really like it too much, but they had a big sleeping porch up on the third floor, sort of open on one side, and they had 20 beds in there, and they had shower rooms, bathrooms, and a lot of graduate students lived there. And that's where I moved in and lived there all the time. I was at Caltech.
Was this your first experience with a dormitory type of accommodations, or?
Yeah. Well, no, that's not quite true. Well, dormitory, yes, I guess, in that sense. So I went to Lawrenceville. I had a room to myself there.
Mm-hmm.
That was pleasant. I liked that. And then I met some people. I guess I met a fellow who was at the Huntington Library for the summer. And he was a type that makes friends, acquaintances quickly. He introduced me to a number of girls, Pasadena girls, and those became very good friends, those and their ultimate husbands and so on. But I had a very good time socially at Caltech in Pasadena. It had little to do with Caltech, but
was this different from Princeton? Princeton was pretty much all male.
There weren't any girls at Princeton.
Yes.
I mean,
no.
It was very difficult.
Not even town girls?
There were very few of them.
Did you live in... where did you live in Princeton, going back?
Well, as an undergraduate, I was in one of the dormitories.
Mm-hmm.
And as a graduate student, I lived out at the graduate college, which is out in the golf course. Quite a distance.
Did you belong to one of the notorious eating clubs or something like that?
As an undergraduate, I did. And
or maybe they weren't considered notorious.
Well,
in
they
those
weren't.
Days.
They were notorious when you think about it. Really objected very strongly eventually, but at that time, well, we didn't think it was notorious. But there was something true about them. They had somebody misguidedly gave a prize, a club with the best standing. Somebody endowed a prize of some kind. Of course, any club that got that prize was immediately socially dead. And our club had some smart people in it, and we got the prize. But it was not, I was not high on the social ladder of the place. It wasn't Ivy.
Well, let's go back to your coursework at Caltech then. Did you have?
I took two courses worth mentioning. One was Pauling's quantum mechanics, which I took. He lectured on quantum mechanics. And the other one was I minored in mathematics, and I had a course in Paul Whitaker and Watson's book, essentially in analysis. That's as far as I got in mathematics. And those I enjoyed those. And also Tolman was there, and I got to know Tolman very well. I was very fond of Tolman.
I can't place Tolman now.
Richard Tolman. Well, he has a big book on statistical mechanics. It's a lovely
all right.
book.
No.
And he did various astrophysical things that I didn't know about as well. But I used to spend hours talking to him. I think he said something in the front of his preface of his book that did thank me for discussions. And we certainly had lengthy discussions. So he sort of used me as somebody to try out his ideas on, especially pedagogic ones, I guess. I admired Tolman. I admired him as his political views. He's a very liberal person. He's sensible. Yes.
Did he continue on the faculty at Caltech?
Yes.
Through his career? Or?
Yes, he did. He died after the war, a couple of years after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then encountered him again during the war when I was in the wartime research operation. He was sort of my contact point with the top people. He was one of the board of trustees, so to speak, of that.
Of the wartime quartermaster, projects were
this
you?
This was the
Woods Hole.
No, I was at Woods Hole originally, but
I became chief of Division 2 of the National Defense Research Committee, and he was in the board of the National Research Committee.
We'll come back to that. As I understand, you took notes from Pauling's course on quantum chemistry.
I guess I took notes. I don't remember about the notes. But
then how did you and he come to write?
Well, the next second year, see, I spent 2 years as a graduate student at Caltech. And the second year, I was a grader in his course. I graded the problems that he handed out. And so that led to a closer connection there. And then following up the next year, which was after I got my degree, my first postdoctoral year, that's when we wrote the book.
Okay, now Pauling got this from his time in Europe.
Pauling had been in Europe, yes, at the critical, one of these lucky people that in Europe at the time of the invention of quantum, the introduction of quantum mechanics. There were a lot of people who were.
You mentioned John Slater.
Slater.
Got his start,
Yeah.
So what particular aspect, or let's see, there was the Schrodinger approach and the
Heisenberg
approach. Which one did
you? Well, he was completely Schrodinger approach, as most people actually. Of course, now that it's so interchangeable, they're all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just different ways of expressing it. But at that time, at first, that was not known.
Yes,
that was separate.
Now, did you get into group theory at this time? Was that something you got into on your own?
Well, I was sad, I'm sorry to say. I read a paper by, I was at Caltech at the time, and I was, I guess, an undergraduate, a graduate student, probably in the last year as a graduate student. And I didn't know anything about molecular vibrations, molecular spectra. But Tolman, there was a colloquium on it. I think Tolman was giving it or talked about it and commented on it. And I got interested in the problem of vibrations of polyatomic molecules, which really was practically nothing. Denison had a couple of papers on CO2, I think, something like that. There's several older papers on CO2. And I read a paper by Kimball and Eyring on use of group theory for valence bond calculation of electronic energies. Well, frankly, there's no great genius required to see that the molecular vibration problem is exactly the same. The group theory that they describe the use of group theory in some treatment of electronic energy levels of symmetrical molecules, and it's just a 5-second step from there to applying it to molecules, which I did. Got very excited and about, because I mean, the things you could do with it are so marvelous. It's so marvelous and so simple that I wrote up a paper to send in, and did send it in. Well, I went around and asked people. I asked several people who did molecular spectra. And they were about, this isn't this known, this method, and they all know anything about it. So I sent in the paper, a quick letter, I think. But meantime, I discovered that Gene Vigner had already published a paper putting the group theory onto the vibrational problem, published in the Göttingen Nachrichten, so a little bit obscure, but the thing is that I'd gone to Brigham, and I was still at Princeton as a graduate student. Brigham came there, and I'd gone to Brigham to see if I could work for him. He had a problem he could propose. And I think he did propose a problem, which I think later became a famous problem. I'm a name trouble again, but the fellow became president of the National Academy of Sciences, had his thesis on that problem. But I fooled around a little bit with it, very short length of time, decided I didn't want to go on with that. Didn't. But go back to Caltech when I was talking, saw this paper by Wigner. I had never talked to Wigner about the problem when I was at Princeton at all. I hadn't talked to Wigner. Seitz is the man who took up the problem that I didn't.
Oh, yeah, Frederick Seitz?
That's Frederick Seitz. Mm-hmm. He did a great job on it. And it got him where he is. But go back to the group theory. I've kept on applying it to things, and I had to withdraw that paper that I sent in because I found it all done. But I guess my contribution was largely spreading the gospel, getting people to realize how simple it was to use and what you could do with it on this problem.
And what was the state of art experimentally of molecular spectroscopy?
As far as polyatomic molecules, it was very near zero, not quite. There was a group at Michigan. Dennison was a theoretician and a very, very good man, too. Dennison had written about normal coordinates. Well, the first paper on a polyatomic molecule was about 1914. The Arum, I think it was. European, carbon dioxide. It was pretty good because there wasn't any quantum mechanics, and it was long before quantum mechanics. But the normal coordinates are a fairly classical idea. You can use it both ways. And then the people at Michigan, there were several experimentalists there. And they had a beautiful equipment, unique in the world, I'd say, at that time. Infrared gratings, spectrometers. But they were working on very simple molecules, triatomics and so on. But of course they had the key thing, which was the normal mode description of the normal coordinates. But there certainly wasn't much else going on at that time. Now in Europe there was Teller present.
Edward Teller?
Edward Teller, yes. Mm-hmm. Hiss. Edward Teller was and Tissot and another fellow whose name escapes me. They were working on the vibration theory and group theory too about that time. But I wasn't up to date. I didn't see their work for a long time.
You still take some exception to Edward Teller's political and
I sure do.
Yeah, philosophy and so on.
I sure do.
Yeah. Well, back to the science. Now, the vibrational spectroscopy, though, was up to that point was still classical mechanics and experimentally.
Well, at the time I got into group theory, the idea of going from normal coordinates, classical normal coordinates, to the application of quantum mechanics to it was known.
Yes.
So my contribution there was not very original. I rediscovered the use of group theory, pretty obvious anyhow.
Well, let's see, your first paper on that subject was The Vibrational Isotope Effect in Polyatomic Molecules by Perturbation Method, or?
Yeah, that didn't have particularly necessarily much to do with group theory.
Yeah. Then you did benzene.
Benzene, that's right. Mm-hmm. Now, the benzene is a straightforward application, but see, Wigner had published the principles there about body. Actually, his example was methane. But people hadn't, just these Europeans were just beginning, I don't know just exactly what month they began working on these things, publishing, I don't know. But the benzene month, that was a straightforward application because it's a beautiful molecule to apply things to. And furthermore, the literature was completely screwy on what people had done to that point. It was Andrews at Johns Hopkins. He had it all wrong. I mean, he had triply degenerate stuff. And I mean, everything was, I mean, group theory showed that everything, practically all the publications were just wrong. But this was a purely theoretical paper. I had a later attempt to assign frequencies, and I made a mistake there too. But the original benzene paper was just an example of an application of group theory, the vibrations of a symmetric molecule.
Let's see, you did some early additional work with J.B. Howard. Was that here at Harvard, or was he out there with you?
Well, he was a Harvard undergraduate, and he went to Caltech, and he didn't like it very much, so he came back to Harvard. So I barely knew him at Caltech. Didn't know him at Caltech, but yeah, I guess, no, I shouldn't say that. That's a mistake, because we worked, actually, I think one of the papers was that. But I did know him at Caltech, and then I knew him. We worked together here much more closely. He was a student of Van Vleck. He came back here.
Oh, I see.
But he and I worked together, and particularly on the separation of the rotation vibration of polyatomic molecules.
Did he take his degree here at the physics department? Or?
He got his degree here, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'd skip back to Caltech. Who were the other professors there, or the faculty there, that particularly influenced?
Well, as I mentioned, Tolman, he's the most. I really saw more of Tolman than I did of Pauling. But of course, when I worked with Pauling on the book, we were constant. The year I was, first year there, my postdoctorate year, we worked together on that very closely.
Did you stay there more or less continuously during those 3 years? Including
yes.
Summers?
Well, I came back home one summer.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see your question.
This is out of order, but I forgot to ask you earlier. You had brothers and sisters?
I had two sisters.
Mm-hmm.
My younger sister is okay. Lives in Washington. My older sister died some years ago. Well, going back to Caltech, we have asked people. I mentioned Tolman. Badger is somebody I saw a fair amount because he was doing infrared molecules, actually.
Kostiakowski indicated that they had to give you some sort of an experimental project so you could get your PhD there.
Well, what happened on that? It's a lesson I learned. It was important to me. Pauling suggested it was a problem looking at nitroso compounds. And you'll notice in the bibliography there's one paper there.
Yes.
And Pauling thought these were colored because of resonance. He was developing the concept of resonance at the time. And he thought the color in that case indicated, well, he thought this was a triplet molecule, that's why. I'm sorry, I made a mistake, I misspoke. He thought that the color was due to the fact that there was a triplet state involved. And he wanted me to measure the magnetic susceptibility, you see, which would tell you the distinguished triplet state.
Well, listen, I hadn't done badly at Princeton
in the research, experimental research. I don't claim anything spectacular. It wasn't true, but I didn't feel that I was clumsy or particularly or incompetent in the laboratory. In fact, I felt fairly confident about it. I had flopped on the summer job with the super cool liquids, but I was a total loss on this simple-minded, conventional balance scheme of magnet.
Do they call it the GUI balance?
The GUI balance, mm-hmm. Exactly. And then you got a analytical balance. You hung the tube from the... Well, the damn thing was always pulling over to the side and rubbing up against the poles of the magnet. And I got very discouraged. I really got terribly discouraged. And what I did is what I've seen many a graduate student do. You have to catch them quick and stop them. You just sort of slow down. You don't show up every day. You don't show up early. You come in late. And I was in that state. It was really, really bad. And finally, I didn't take much arguing, but Pauling put me on a theoretical job, took me off that. I did finally get the thing. It is diamagnetic, it's not triple state. That's the paper. It's a real hassle for me to put around a very simple.
See, I can put some on my face in the cord right now. Okay, what was your thesis at Caltech then?
It was on the calculation of the ground state of lithium atom. It was nothing, I mean, frankly. Never give a student a PhD on this consequential thesis.
But you had other work, publications in progress, or did you?
At that time, as a student, I think I was struggling to do the experiment first and then calculating. We went on to calculate, beryllium next. That was a big, that was a much bigger job. And Pauling provided me with a fellow student as a calculator for me. Things.
Were you using a mechanical calculator?
Yeah.
Some kind of build?
Well, I don't know if they had a motor on it. They eventually became motorized, you know. Just put a motor on them, but same thing.
Thinking of that puts me ahead, but I was going to ask you whatever happened to A. Sprague Coolidge's mechanical calculator, which you had here.
You mean it's historical?
Yes, from historical interest. Do you think it was
long ago junk?
The Smithsonian Institution is interested in collecting.
Oh, I see. Well, we've got
historical things like that, and maybe later we ought to go through a possible list of
yes,
if there are things.
That, like, we certainly had them around for a long time.
To us, at least, that mechanical calculator would have been interesting. Maybe not to everyone. All right, let's. We need to push on to Harvard.
That's right.
We're hardly getting there yet.
I know.
How did you come to get your appointment at Harvard?
Right. Well, I was in my. I had 1 year postdoctoral year following. We worked on the book. And I got a telegram one day saying that been elected to the Society of Fellows at Harvard. I haven't heard of the Society of Fellows. I had a great, no, this was the year, this was my last graduate, the second year at Caltech, my last graduate year. And Pauling, am I still messing this up?
No.
Pauling was away on a trip, and he had offered me a job for his first graduate year, and I had accepted. So when I got the telegram from Harvard, I quickly wrote back, or wired back, that thank you very much, I appreciate this honor, but I had agreed to accept your position for that year. Well, then Pauling got back. He was mad because I'm sure, you know, that's the Depression, and he had a number of students on the leave. I'm sure he felt that, yeah, I had a good job. He could have taken that money and handed it to one of his other students. At any rate, he said, I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have. And he explained what the guy was about. He knew that. I hadn't heard it. So,
had he probably recommended you to for this? Or?
I don't think he had originally, but he might have. I think it was Bill Richards that did it. His uncle was the head of the Society of Fellows, the Major Domo.
So did you? Could you reverse your decision, or did you have to wait until the following year?
They re-elected me the next year. It was the first. You see, the telegram came for the first year of the society. It just been founded.
Uh-huh.
So I was elected to the first year, but except that they elected me the next year. Richard said, well, you know, there are people on the board that think you turned it down, you shouldn't be elected, but my uncle didn't feel that way. So it was what happened. Lucky for me.
What did you do while you were a junior fellow?
I worked on a lot of things. It was a very productive time for me scientifically, because I had free time. I had particularly with Howard, we worked on the separation, rotation, and vibration, Hamiltonian, for the idea that you can write an effective Hamiltonian, like for, so you treat this rigid body, but the parameters change from one vibrational state to another. And that Hamiltonian is now obsolete. Well, it still is. But, and we worked on on ethane, that is following internal rotation. We did quite a bit of work together, and quite a number of, I can't tell you how many of them, I think it's for that period of 2 years, but a number of them were. So that was a very good time for me.
The duties of the society fellows were,
they weren't any,
very nominal.
Right. I went to see Henderson when I arrived. And, you know, after the preliminaries, I sort of said, well, now what am I supposed to do? Oh, he was outraged. You're not supposed to do anything. No duties. I mean, it's true. I mean, I was absolutely a free agent. He said, you can work with somebody if you want to, or you can go talk to people, you can take any courses you want. You got to decide.
This could be disastrous for some people, I think.
Well, it probably is.
Yes,
not everybody has done well. From, most people have, I must say. It's a tremendous list of Nobel Prize laureates who've been members of the Society of Fellows. Mm-hmm. I might have put them in upside down every time.
All right, I think we're on side four now, and did you get into any experimental work then during this period in the Society of Fellows?
I'm trying to remember that I did either that year or the next year. I tried to set up a long path near infrared spectrometer setup, and for basement I had a long pipe about 100 feet long, and I had some spectrometer like a Kistiakowski, I'm sure. When I was here, I had two people who were very, very helpful to me. One was Kistiakowski, and I did try some experimental work, which was a failure. And the other was Van Vleck, who was the most helpful on mechanical regime. Yeah, I tried to do this far infrared work. I can't remember whether it was that year, the first year when I was in the faculty, which was the following year.
Was there any experimental or infrared work going on here then?
No, there wasn't. Only spectroscopy, I guess, was George was doing some fluorescence and visible spectroscopy.
Let's see, you were in the Society of Fellows for 3 years, or?
I only stayed 2 years. It was a 3-year appointment. But they offered me a job. See, the second year in the Society, our book had come out, and I gave a lecture course from it while I was in the Society.
Mm-hmm.
And the department offered me an assistant professorship, and I resigned the Society and took the assistant professorship.
Okay. And you began teaching physical chemistry then? Or what?
Right away, yes. I gave that quantum mechanics course before I was appointed to the faculty. Then, when I was in the first year as a faculty member, I took over the physical chemistry course from my predecessor who didn't get promoted. And I had about 100 students in that course.
What was the general content of the physical chemistry you taught then?
Thermodynamics is the center of my emphasis.
Did you develop your own notes or use someone's text?
I pretty much developed my own notes, though I had a text, but there were, of course, many texts available, and I wasn't ever very happy with any of the texts. I did recommend one.
I believe Jud Wells was your first graduate student?
Jud Wells was my first graduate student. Jack Howard was in a special category. He was not a graduate student, mine, because I was in the Society of Fellows initially at the time. It worked better. He certainly was, as part of his thesis, his collaborative work we had together. The Wells came along as the first real graduate student.
And you built an infrared spectrometer at that time?
Well,
went on?
What happened there was that George Kistiakowski gave me an assistant, a postdoctoral fellow. He happens to have ended up for retirement as the head of the Shell Development Company, but at that time he was Harold Shinowitz.
Oh, yes.
And he came to meet with me, George paid for him, and he became postdoctoral with me. And it really was Shinowitz, largely. So we worked together on it, but he was crucial to build a semi-automatic infrared spectrometer. It was the queerest thing you ever saw.
Yeah, would you describe it? I've heard tales about it and never saw it.
Well, we had one machine piece built for us. But then there was a typewriter carriage and some ratchets. And there was a motor-driven thing that turned a couple of cranks around. The cranks had strings to them, and various things happened. First of all, there were two cells one on top of the other, and they moved up and down in this mechanical contrivance when it was running. And they'd move up and put the blank cell in, and move down and put the fill cell in the path. And then there were strings that pulled the typewriter cab so that the photographic paper was moved a notch at a time. And the machinery moved the prism, rotated the prism by a definite amount each cycle, you see. So this thing was, you let it going and it ran itself. Things went on.
Oops.
It worked on strings and it developed, put a bar, it put the blank and the zero and so on this photographic paper. So you had to remeasure, you had to measure the photographic paper after it. You could do so at your leisure. And we also had interchangeable prisms, so we had a little tiny potassium bromide prism for going a little further into the infrared than you could do with rock salt.
The sodium chloride with the regular prism.
Sodium chloride.
How long would it take to run a spectrum?
Well, about a week.
That's right.
I mean, something you could do on an early Perkin Elmer, half an hour, I guess. It takes about 5 days, 4 or 5 days.
What was the source?
Global.
And it stayed stable that long?
Well, we had zeros every cycle. We had a couple of zeros and a blank. Mm-hmm. No, things could, on a bad day, they drift all over the place. But it's largely a question of temperature drifts, I think. We had optical amplifier on the thermocouple system. Galvanometer was from the directly to the thermocouple. Galvanometer was then amplified by a second galvanometer. Question of a grid, slots, and two brass plate. And as the light from the prism from the galvanometer swung across this thing, you got light going through the slots or not going through the slots, depending on where. And you could get enormous amplification up to Brownian motion, no problem at all. So you were struck by the noise and the bouncing around and the drifts limited the sensitivity.
This was mounted on in the basement or on a.
There's a big pier still there. Well, no, they actually ripped it out. There's a pier in the sub basement. It's in the box because otherwise if water comes in, groundwater comes in. So there's a box up to the first floor and then a concrete pier inside this in the, not on the first floor, but the basement floor from the sub-basement. And we sat on that pier and did our best on the noise and vibration.
Any parts of this spectrometer still in existence?
I don't think so. I'm afraid not.
Was that an advance in the state of the art at the time, or?
I would say it was, yes. Michigan, which was the place, they were operated by a graduate student writing down the reflections of the galvanometer, P, zero, blank, and write it in the notebook. Because we had to measure just exactly those same quantities out of the photographic paper.
Yes. So when did the first commercial infrared spectrometers arrive?
Pretty early.
Did you get
we
one
got,
here in the
this department field? Got one of the first one from not Perkin Elmer.
Baird. Was it Baird or was
Baird? This department got that. We had nothing to do with other organic chemistry. So that was certainly a number of years later then. I don't know when that was. Perkin Elmer, I do know, was during the war. So stories about that.
Yes. You never did really get much into the experimental side of infrared and vibrational spectroscopy, did you?
Well,
beyond,
no.
Let's see, by the intensity measurements with Judd Wells.
Intensity measurements with Judd Wells, and people still use that method. It's not a good method, but that's the half, I guess. It's difficult to get the results with it, but it is. And that's an example of what I meant by sometimes what I do is to get out of people executing. Send it that well.
Let me jump ahead or jump out momentarily because somewhere along here I should really ask you what you feel your most significant contributions were in
well the I think one of them that had a lot of effect. You know, all these things are very simple, really, when you look at them. And I wish I could give you a sophisticated answer to my discovery of this or that. It's startling.
You sound like Peter Debye explaining to us how simple his theories of Palmer physics work. And,
yeah.
And not being believed. continue.
This work with Howard on the Hamiltonian has really been used a great deal of in the basis. You think about it, it's pretty obvious. But that has, and then nowadays, of course, there are modern versions which are much more sophisticated. But people still mostly use this idea model. Now, on the group theory, I think I had an influence by the fact that I didn't discover it. That's how the salesman for the technique. I certainly had a great deal of pleasure applying it myself to a large number of molecules. The spectrometer is nothing. I mean, that was an ephemeral there. Infrared spectrometer. We did a number of molecules on it. Some good people like Bryce Crawford and Jack Bennett did molecules working with me. I had a marvelous group my first year as an assistant professor. Those people on it there were really, really good.
Let's see, was Bryce Crawford a postdoctoral?
Yes, he got a one we had in those days. And he'd been working with Paul Cross as a graduate student, sent him to me. The paper for which has had the most demand, reprints and so on, sort of same story, the FG method for things like the vibrations. And
could you describe that briefly?
Well, it's really, again, something well known to mathematicians. I remember we know that we have, am I spoiling this again?
I don't think it's you. I think I'm, no, I'm all right. It seemed to be cutting out when I would speak. We're all right now, thank you.
Well, let me get this where I was.
The FG matrix.
The F, of course, is just force constant matrix. Quadratic force field. G is a way of expressing kinetic energy. And I think that I think this is very well known in mathematicians, applied mathematicians and so on. But it was not well known in this game, in this application. And I wrote a paper, first paper on it, and
It got abstracted in chemical abstracts as follows. M-A-T-H, period. That is the entire abstract. And I wasn't the only one to suffer from that, because they just had nobody to do theoretical papers, and so many of the abstracts were like that. But later on, a few years ago, there's a journal that, I forget which one it is, that has little articles every month on highly quoted papers. Somebody asked me to write up about the FG method. Been quoted so much, so often. I wrote what I said, but it didn't get quite that kind of play when it came out. But that is generally, I'd say, the most quoted paper, and of course, partly because in the book, on electric vibrations. And, going along,
the microwave spectroscopy, of course.
Yes. I worked on vibrational spectra for a while, and then the war came along, and I worked on a little bit longer, but not much, mainly writing helping tactics to get the book out. And then I moved almost immediately after the war to microwave spectroscopy, because it had been done during the war by MIT radiation lab people. Now the Stark effect spectrometer is again just like my tungsten platinum invention, product of ignorance. And I'm a great believer in products of ignorance. We never do anything. But it was really so, because seemed perfectly obvious to do this, modulate this thing with the field. It is perfectly obvious. I think a dozen people would have come on it a week later. But I didn't know I didn't understand anything about it. And I didn't know, for example, that the main source of noise is 1/F noise. And that's what the spark effect does. It pushes you up in frequency.
Yes.
No, I didn't know about that. It just seemed an obvious thing to try, and I had the cues put together with the machinery and tried it. And the first time we turned that on, it was just great. It was a great feeling. I was there with him. Put ammonia in the system. Now, ammonia is the only molecule really we could do before. Very long path. So, basically infinite on the 339. That was a very exciting moment when the first started. I will boast a little bit, but we made this thing available to people. Anybody wanted to come and see me, I came and see me. Just coming out of the war, everybody was so secret in those days, because they'd only trained to be secret. And we tried to fight that, and did. The people went and built them immediately, their own system. And of course, other people thought of it, had thought of it at the same time. Like a fellow at Pittsburgh, Westinghouse. Actually went to their patent department with a patent, and we applied for a patent, but we waited until the last minute, in fact, before we applied. And they had preceded us by nearly a year in applying, but we got the patent in the end because we had reduced it to practice. They never made one.
Did you ever get anything out of that patent?
I think a few $1,000 altogether. We gave it to the Research Corporation eventually, or arranged for them to take it over. And they sold licenses to Hewlett Packard. and to another place. But, of course, there was an exemption for government use, and I think Hewlett-Packard spectrometer was sold almost exclusively to government agencies at first. And I think by the time they got around to having anything that had any royalties, that got to run out. So that is not a financial demand.
Microwave spectroscopy never really took off in the way that NMR did, or infrared.
I've often wondered if that isn't partly my fault, to be honest. Because, you know, I sort of, you fellows as students, I had a real monopoly situation. But if you look at the people who did microwave spectroscopy, so many of them had been here, but I did have a particularly special position. And that's not good.
Well, it was tough competition, though. You had Charlie Towns some work going on at MIT. I forget who was there.
The GE?
At MIT.
Yes, Dennis Strandberg was.
Yes, yeah.
There's no doubt. You see, first it was physicists. And in this kind of business, physicists are a lot smarter than chemists, let's face it. Except they don't, you see, they know too much sometimes. Charlie Towns, because he knew you had to use a superheterodyne type, you know, beating the frequency down. That's not so, as we showed, but we showed it out of ignorance. I mean, yes, I don't want to claim that, I mean, Charlie Towns is number one in this game, was. Strandberg is a very capable guy, and there are many others who are in his business, but they didn't go into doing polyatomic molecules, I can assure you, when we started with them. They were doing diatomics, if possible, or no more.
Oh, that's right.
Physical phenomenon, go on.
You pushed into the internal rotational problem.
In fact, I
came cropper on nitromethane. I couldn't solve that one. Gwynn's group beat me on that one.
Yeah, that was too bad. I would say I was pushed into the internal rotation because I'd been involved with George earlier with a lot of the vibrational molecules we studied. Involving the methane, the ethane problem. The works have several papers on that. For example, the theory of the statistical weights and so on. So I was very interested in internal rotation in an earlier state. The game possibly be this microwave business. There, I must say, you fellows pushed me into that pretty hard.
I thought you pushed us.
Well, it was part of both ways, but Trilb and of course Hirschbach later, a little bit later. Other people who worked in the beginning there. I wasn't quite prepared to push it as far as, for example, Trilb insisted on doing.
You'd sort of run out of rigid rotors by the mid-50s.
That's still not run out of, except what the interest has. The interpretation is an important.
Let me jump ahead to... you wrote one very good paper on group theory application to NMR spectra of symmetrical molecules. And then you did nothing more in NMR, as far as I can call.
Well, you know, you said earlier that microwave hasn't played the role that NMR has. Of course, it's nowhere near playing the role that NMR has. You know, there's certain obvious reasons for that. First, the liquid state. But, I don't know if it's a little hard to say what I should have done, but I think we could have done a lot better.
I was never able to sell gas phase microwave spectroscopy and DuPont. I don't think anybody had much success in industry. It's almost the same as with electron diffraction, gas phase electron diffraction.
First, the limitations of gas phase is a very extreme limitation. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the dipole moment requirement is somewhat of a limitation. And it doesn't have the universal applicability that NMR has, nowhere near. It's a marvelous tool. I think it's a marvelous tool, and I still love it. Frankly, I wish I could go on and do more of them.
In your later career, you got into reaction kinetics via double resonance experiments.
Well, we did have some relaxation time. But there we were really scooped by Oka, Takeshi Oka. Mm-hmm. He did a much better job than we did. He was to it. Did a lot of molecules. That was a fairly disappointing performance.
I wanted to ask about the book Introduction to Scientific Research. What prompted you to write that?
Well, I guess my wartime experience, where we did some goofing on watching the news of the war situation. I won't go into the details of that, but that's reduced the statistics. We did a mistake in one of our projects, and it's because of my ignorance of statistics. I've got to learn something about this.
I did quite a bit of reading on operations research, and I can't remember who. I think there was a book titled Operations Research that probably was Kimball's book, but your book was basically in part
it was that sort
based
of
on that sort of.
I don't think that I'm still a fellow member of the Operations Research Society of America. I don't know why I pay my year because I haven't done anything since wartime with it. But
you wrote that when you were at Oxford.
I had a sabbatical at the right moment after the war, 2950, and I had collected a bunch of ideas on cards. I'd carry in my pocket and I'd pull out an index card, ask somebody, well, what's your favorite scientific joke, or what do you think about scientific matter? What's the special thing that you like? Everybody has a special thing that they believe in, a special trick or a special theorem or something. So I collect a lot of these cards. I found them the other day. There's a whole batch of them. And those were the basis for the book, which I put together in Oxford. And pretty well did it that year. And I had a lot of fun writing that book. Really enjoyed it.
was Raymond C. Ferguson on the morning of Tuesday, November 18th, 1986. I am in Professor E. Bright Wilson's office again, continuing the interview started yesterday. I did review the tapes we made yesterday, and I, you mentioned informally that you weren't particularly happy about your World War II government work, but I think we ought to cover that a little bit anyway.
Yeah.
What? How did you get involved at Woods Hole in that project?
Well, that came about one day in the fall of France. There was considerable agitation around, and Dr. Conant, president of Harvard at the time, was one of the people who started the National Defense Research Council, which was a government agency, but under the president, office of the presidency, and it was devoted to utilizing university research capabilities, wartime research, and this, of course, before we were in the war, but right after the fall of France. And this got announced in the paper or something, and at any rate, just Yakovsky knew about it, and he said, well, we got to go over there and talk to Conant now about see what we can do. We did that, and Conant said, well, why don't you work on explosives, chemists, so on. Well, I had no experience whatsoever with explosives. Kostyakovsky's experience was multiple, but accidents in his laboratory. But we agreed to do that. And I got a few people together, set up a committee to look at theory of explosions. That had on it, ultimately, Jack Kirkwood, the leading person on it, and then a little later we got John von Neumann in there, and he was terrific, and was very, very important what he did. One of the things he wanted to do was to repeat the old experiments of Mach, M-A-C-H, I guess he is, Mach 1, Mach 2, so on. And he had done his experiments with smoke plate, glass plate, and then sparks, electric sparks, the plate arrangement. Just make a shock wave sending out from the spark and blow the soot away in patterns. And Mach discovered the interaction of two finite shock waves. It gave a special effect. And we went over to Radcliffe and permanently borrowed their ancient Wimshurst electrostatic machine, you know, making charging.
The continuous belt that
well, we cranked it,
and
it was a disc or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, we made it static electricity, and we just repeated those old experiments of Mach in the laboratory, plus additional ones suggested by von Neumann, and this turned out to be quite important. And
Do this yourself or have students?
That was actually being done, that particular kind of thing was being done by Bill Kennedy, who later became director of research at Tennessee Eastman. He had an accident and died a few years ago. But I don't want to go into too much detail, but the next thing that happened was that in this organization, they set up an explosives division, and at first Kostyakovsky, I think, was vice chairman of it, and then he was head of it for a while. And one of the things they wanted to do was set up an underwater test laboratory, and he asked me to do that. So I went around looking for a place to put it, and by accident,
ran in with some people I knew in New York after getting off the train, and ended up on my studying at the laboratory at Woods Hole, inside of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And we started with two people, Bob Cole, and he was later, I guess, before or later at Brown, student of Van, former student of Van Vleck, still there. And a fellow named Slifko, his assistant under Cole. We ended up at the end of the war with about 100 people. I think about 25 or 30 of them are scientists, PhDs. And we studied physics of explosives, explosions, and the power of different chemical mixtures and so on. And the net result of one of our accomplishments was to persuade the Navy to change their explosives from TNT to a more powerful, newer kind, which the making of which was done by other people in the same National Defense under Tistikowski's group. And the testing of the safety was done in their laboratory at Pittsburgh, they set up. And the power and so on was studied in this hole, both in air and in water. We also did things about fuses and a variety of things that came, we were set up to do. And we were ultimately set up to measure pressure waves and some explosions in air and in water.
What kind of devices did you use to measure the pressures?
Well, there were piezoelectric gauges. And we owe a great, great deal to the British, I should say. Whereas we never found a single earlier report on any of these subjects. We never got our hands on any. I don't think there were any in our military establishment. The British had an elaborate classified publicity, exchange of information, sort of reports and things. There were lots of interesting reports, one of which worked on between the wars. One of these was using piezoelectric gauges, but they were great big things. They didn't have any amplifiers in those days. No vacuum tubes were just coming in. But anyway, that's what we did. We had certainly worked hard. We did learn how to measure these pressures. It was difficult. We didn't get it right first time.
I think this was your first exposure to vacuum tubes and electronics. Except for your radio, maybe at home.
I was a radio amateur as a boy, and yes, we didn't have much. I certainly didn't do anything with electronics. I remember before that, but I didn't do much in the war. But Bob Cole was in charge of the electronics for the water work, and George Frankel was. Bill Kennedy was in charge of the whole thing for the air blast, and George Frankel, Columbia, was the electronics man for the air group.
I brought this up because I recalled you said sometime when I was working for you that after the war you had an impulse to smash every vacuum tube you ever found. Were they that unreliable, or that you had a lot of problems with?
Had lots of problems. Yes, I'd say one had a lot of problems. Of course, millions of them made, and a billion, and how many vacuum tubes were made? We made radios, by the enormous
number. Yes.
Dump them overboard, crash them, break them, throw it away, get the next one. And the vacuum tubes were being produced at a fantastic rate during the war for the military purposes.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to start, I hate to divert you again. Let's keep going.
I interrupted. Go ahead.
No. Well, I don't really have anything else much to say. It offered good people there.
Did you live at Woods Hole during this time?
I moved down with my family. What happened was that I was first in charge of organizing this laboratory and the director of it, of this sub-laboratory, because we were inside the Woods Hole Oceanographic. We called ourselves the Underwater Explosions Search Laboratory. And we did have our own contracts with the, through the Institute. And the main job was desperation, getting people. It's the radar group at MIT and many others, of course, of the Los Alamos operation, gobbling up every scientifically trained person in the country get their hands on.
Of course, I'm trying to remember. Was Don Hornig?
Don Hornig had started his graduate work with me. Started on his thesis with the thermocouple business. And then when and he moved to Woods Hole when the rest of us moved. And then George came, Gifstikowski, who was my boss in the organization. He was the division chief for this explosives work. And he was transferred to Los Alamos. And then he went on a manhunt, and he grabbed Don Hornig. Came out there, and Don was very important to him, I think. Los Alamos.
Well, then you went on to another job with the...
At some point, they reorganized the system a bit, and they split off as a Division 3, I think it was called, I forget. Division 8 was explosives, I remember that. Two or three, I can't remember.
Division 2, I think, two, of something
right.
I...
Two was the sort of effects of explosions. Originally started out as passive protection from bombing. But I had nothing to do with that. But they reorganized it. And my major I became a civil servant at that point. Moved, and my official location was Washington, the sort of sublocation of Woods Hole. Maybe the other way around, Woods Hole. The office was in Washington. And I had under my contract responsibility of Princeton Woods Hole primarily, and a separate operation at Duke. And so I did the round trip every week from Woods Hole to Washington to Princeton to Providence. Took the boat across in the morning to Woods Hole. It was quite an operation.
And you continued to live in Woods Hole?
I continued to live in Woods Hole.
Who was minding the store here at Harvard while you were away?
Wasn't much to mind. A few girls around, a few boys. But they did run they threw the Radcliffe and Harvard together at that point. And Ralph Halford had been at Harvard as a research postdoctoral fellow with George, and he stayed and taught the consolidated a lot of things, but he stayed and did the teaching as needed. Very grateful for that.
Okay, talking about your public service or government service, though, could we jump ahead and just talk briefly about your year with the Weapons Systems Evaluation Group in Washington?
Yes. Well, that was the Korean War got me into that. And I was in England, actually. I had been, when they asked me to join it. And you remember, I couldn't remember the name, but Robertson. This is a fellow I did my thesis work with in the Common Mechanics at Princeton, senior thesis. He was the research director of this operations analysis group. which worked for the Secretary of Defense and for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They were the customers. And Robertson was the research director, the deputy and deputy director. They had a military general as the head of it, director. And then General Keyes. And he'd been there for a couple of years, and sort of in a situation in the government sometimes gets to where if you can't get a successor, you stay. So you work and get your own successor, get out of there. And people are on leave of absence, sort of things. At any rate, long and short, they recruited me for this job. You see, the only reason why I thought I could conceivably have any competence there is I began thinking about this scientific method business, the statistics, Edwards Hall.
Yeah, actually, you wrote your book, Introduction to Scientific Research, before this job, though, didn't you? It issued in 1952, I believe, and it seems to me you worked on that at Oxford.
Not, of course, much earlier than that. That's true. That's perfectly true. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's not to quibble, but I think your point's well taken. I just was. I think there were one or two points in Kistiakowsky's article in this Festscript issue that I thought were. The dates were not factually correct. The sequences were not entirely correct, according to my recollection.
I think that's completely true.
Yeah.
And I found errors in there.
Yeah.
I should put a correction somewhere. I don't know where to put it.
But this was, it was really your experience, though, and expertise in the scientific method operations research.
I had no professional qualifications whatsoever as an operations analyst. I hadn't done anything. I didn't belong to that crowd in any way, shape, or form.
What did you think about the quality and the competence of the people you worked with down there in Washington?
Well, it was a mixed bag. First of all, we just had hardly any civilians. It was pitiful. We had about five, ten civilians. We were supposed to have a lot more than that, but they hadn't recruited them or got them in. So when I went down there, the first job I had to do was to find some people. And I did find some people, and it was a heck of a job, because after I'd found them, they had to be cleared, and it took forever to get them cleared, and they froze, when the Republicans came in, they froze the situation. If I'd had the civil service approval to find these bodies, to take them on if I could find them, as soon as I found them, Charlie Wilson, the Secretary of Defense, froze everything.
Mm.
And it was desperate. I had these people who'd given up their jobs, you know, and they had nothing to eat with, because they couldn't take the new job. And they'd given up their old one. One of those was George Rastin, I might say, who's quite important in the effects of nuclear weapons, the control, question of control of nuclear weapons. He has sort of a public policy professorship at MIT.
Hmm.
There were a few very good people, but they're just a hard instance. And the rest of the group of military, we had a General Keyes, who's a lieutenant general at the head. We had an army general and a navy admiral and an army, what did I say? Well, we had three flag rank people. And then there were colonels galore, I don't know how many, and a few lieutenant colonels, and that's low down. So we had one sergeant, he did all the work. It was rather funny because
Keep going on that. Anything you want to say?
Well, the thing is, I could hear the orders. We would talk to General Keyes in his office, and then I'd go back to my office, and I'd hear him go, and I'd hear him call the executive man in, and then the executive man was at his rank, I could hear him going to the next office, and then the next office. Because the orders were passed out. I know where they did. In the sergeant's lap.
Did you... I assume you thought this multi-tiered bureaucracy was pretty inefficient, and, or did you?
Well, you see, it was a very strange thing. You couldn't really judge. I'll just cut that one out and pass that one, because I think it's too special a kind of organization. But I'll just say this. The thing that I saw there that upset me terribly was the inter-service rivalry. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible, and childish in the extreme. But, you know, the wording of the we'd get directives from these people, and they'd fight for weeks over the wording and the detailed wording of the directive, that it might give the Navy an advantage over the other, or vice versa. Inter-service rivalry was fantastic, and of course still is.
Yes. Okay, let's see. Before we finish, I wanted to have you talk a bit about your family, and maybe this is a good time. Tell me a little bit about Emily Buckingham.
Well, I'll start with her father. Her father was a professor at MIT of mechanical engineering. He was probably the world's greatest authority on, certainly a very important one, in the gear business. Gear theory. Got out many books of tables and so on, design of gears, and did a lot of very important consulting on gears. So that's where we met. His wife is a fine person, not technically. And Emily went as far as a master's degree in physics. And
where did she go? At MIT?
At Harvard.
At Harvard.
She was Radcliffe. She was Radcliffe. I'd been a Radcliffe student. Stayed on for a master's degree and was teaching at Wellesley when I came back from Caltech and met her and got married. Kenneth was the first child. And he's here today giving a lecture.
Yes, I'll jump out of sequence a little bit. You've nurtured at least a couple of Nobel Prize winners, and one parenting, and I guess Debbie Hirschbach. Anybody else?
That's all. I think that's it.
Did you get to go to the award ceremony for Kenneth?
Yes, we did. He was very generous and sent the whole crowd, and it was quite a crowd. And we had a marvelous time. They do a terrific job, you know. They really work at this thing year after year after year. I don't see how they put up with it. They do. The king and the queen and so on, they're all on deck for the occasions. They're quite fabulous.
Well, were you surprised?
I
knew Kenneth just...
I was surprised earlier
when I was here,
because he hadn't, when he got promoted to tenure, that was the place where I had misjudged the situation myself. I remember talking to Kenneth about the publications.
At Cornell, about his publications? Or?
Yes, about the necessity for publishing things and how to get ahead in this world, the academic world. Well, he, in his usual manner, said nothing. But very soon thereafter, I discovered that Cornell was equal to the task of recognizing his abilities without requiring a long list of publications. The publications came later, after he got tenure. Now, I think it's probably Hans Bethe, mostly, that responsible for that. So, yes, the Nobel Prize wasn't a surprise, because people talked about it so much around here, you know. Physicists would tell me, oh, he's sure to get it, and so on. And I was a little bit annoyed because time passed and didn't get it. You know?
I see.
Those things aren't all that rational and good to ensure that the right thing, you know, this father's judgment isn't right in the first place. But finally, it did happen.
Well, now, let's see, on to David. I didn't, I confused you yesterday because I was asking about David and thinking of Kenneth.
Right. Well, David is an associate professor. No, he's a full professor. David is a full professor also at Cornell, but in the field of biochemistry. And he's an active man. He's done some nice work. And, you know, it's a little bit hard to have a brother. I'll cut that out. But you know how it is.
Oh, fine.
Sibling competition is important. But David has done very nice work, continues to do so. Say right now he's in a scientifically very, very good situation.
And Nina?
Well, Nina is got a, we're still in the PhD category. She got a degree in economics. And she married a physicist. Had a degree in economics. And then she had a job, she's had a number of important jobs, but she was with the staff of the Federal Communications Commission until the Republicans came in. This was a presidential appointment, so she had to sign that one. So she set up a private practice as a consulting economist. And she does what she's doing now. She, again, I don't think I'll cut this one, but she was the sultan of the football league that was suing the other football league.
Oh, really?
A few months ago.
Did that only get you interested in canoeing and outdoor life, or vice versa? I think.
I always liked canoeing, at Princeton I did a lot of that. So I don't think that she certainly liked it, was very enthusiastic about it. But I can't say that she started me on that.
Now, Therese. Is that pronounced right?
Therese. That's not, mine isn't right either, never has been, but I, it's the best I can do.
Oh, I, yes, I, I guess I was, I hadn't realized how much of an accent she has until she answered the phone. I think when I talked to her before, it wasn't quite as strong as when you heard her on the phone. But continue.
Well, after Emily's death, I met Therese here. She came to this country, postdoctoral fellow, Miss George Sisters Hospital. She was a PhD, well, the equivalent of a PhD in Brussels, University of Brussels in physical chemistry. She won a trip to America, a year in America. She came work with George.
Sorry, pause.
Yeah, okay.
Please continue with your
what
about Therese.
I should backtrack a bit of it, right? Very too much. And she got her master's degree, but she didn't, and she taught for the rest of the year, but then kind of came along and stopped working. And our best year really was in England at the time of my sabbatical after the war. That was a very successful year. I wrote this method book. Emily was, we had an old house, you know, really, really old house there, beautiful place. And we're right next to a little village. And Emily got really incorporated into the life of that village. She used to play the organ for the Sunday school and go to the women's club meetings and so on. She really had a, it was a wonderful year for both of us. And when she got suddenly ill, I was in England. Boy, that was hard. That's all I can say. It was tough because I couldn't communicate half the time. Telephone system in Britain was just atrocious, you know. And
this was in
1951, 52? This was 49, 51, 52, I think so.
Oh, wait a minute, no.
49, 50, I think it was.
No, it was, no, I'm that was the period that you were at Oxford.
That's right.
But then,
that's what I'm speaking about, is the Oxford.
The Oxford period.
At first, I mean, that's when the book was written. Then later, I was in England just for a trip, you see.
How about the year in Washington? Did Emily and the family enjoy that, or was that a...
Well, not too terrifically, I'd say. You know, it was all secret. I couldn't talk about what I was doing at all. We only had one car, and, well, I didn't drive the car every day, but I don't know. It wasn't an overwhelming success.
Going back, did you and Emily talk a lot about science?
To a certain extent, but not in detail, you see, because, I mean, yes and no. Probably too much. I mean, Kenneth obviously had it sort of. He took a very, he was demanding of my time.
Well, I remember the summer we stayed in your house when you were on working on the book with Decius and Cross. I ran across some of Kenneth's math papers, and I was just overwhelmed at what he was doing at that time.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, it was group theory, I think, rather advanced group theory of some kind. Well,
he was certainly very advanced and questioning all the time. Mm-hmm. Well, going, did meet Therese at a critical point, and
I interrupted your commenting about you were in England when Emily became ill.
That's right. As I say, it was very dreadful for me because first I had great difficulty in communicating because the telephone system was so bad. There was really only one public telephone in Oxford anywhere near there. And it, of course, was either occupied or out of order half the time. And then getting back, I went over on a MATS, military air transport, because I had an ONR contract. And I couldn't go back. As soon as I heard that the word, and they were sick, they were serious, I tried to get home. And I did get home in a few days, but it took a few days to get on a plane. And rough. And then she died almost immediately after I got home.
Must have been very fast.
It was very fast.
No warning, I mean, of any indication.
Well, she hadn't been in good health, but we never figured out, people hadn't figured out what it was. I don't know why they didn't, but it was an obvious incompetence.
It was leukemia, was it?
Leukemia, yes. Mm-hmm.
Now on to Therese.
We met and we got married pretty quick soon. I don't know, a few months. I wasn't going to let her go back home. So we got married quickly. And, as I say, she has a little bit of a PhD. She's doing research with George. And,
did she continue with her research until the children came? Or?
She continued with her research at first, and then had a sabbatical after a couple of years. We went to Geneva for the sabbatical, and Anne was born in Geneva. And that was... Well, the three children are a year apart. Anne and Paul are a year plus or minus a couple of days. And Paul is a year, and Stephen's a year, 2 months younger.
And what are these children doing?
Well, Paul is a graduate. Anne, first, has had an amazing experience. She has been about seven or eight expeditions to the jungles of the Amazon in Peru, studying monkeys, a special kind of a monkey. So she's writing a thesis now at Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, in behavior, by behavioral biology, animal behavior, especially these little monkeys. And she has found that they're quite special in that they are, they often have two males and one female in the family. And let's say she's been down there, she's accumulated a vast amount of detailed data on these behavioral qualities. She is married, and I don't know what is going to happen. She's now writing a thesis, putting it together, and I think this spring she'll certainly get a degree. And what'll happen next, we don't know.
The next is Paul.
Paul is a graduate student. He's a graduate student at Berkeley. In biology also, but entirely different. I mean, he's looking at frog embryo and how they go and differentiate, and particularly how they control patterns. And
sounds somewhat similar to Doty's current interest in differentiation of collagen.
Uh-huh. Well, this is a great field for study, this question of why does this cell become an ear and not in a big toe and so on. Paul is quite mathematically gifted. Well, he's had a checkered career so far, put it that way. As he did physics as an undergraduate. General relativity, his thesis was an application of general relativity. He went from there to fool around a little bit while, and then he went to London a year at the London School of Economics. And where he got, I might say, a distinction. What do they call it? A degree with a distinction or something like that. And he worked for a while for an MIT professor, had big contracts in South America. So he worked on that, and he actually briefed the South American people on the results of the MIT work. A big meeting they had down there. Then he, well, and then he switched over to biology, which he had studied quite a bit of in Princeton. And he's still working at it. I think he's permanently, well, permanent's a long word, but I think he is well launched, and he's been out there 3 years now. They've treated him extremely well. I'm really enormously impressed by the way these group professors have treated Paul.
Now, Stephen.
Well, Stephen went to Harvard, but he didn't finish. He dropped out. Did sociology. He dropped out in his junior, at the end of his junior year, to set up a little company. But he'd worked as a technician at in this biology building, and building little gadgets that were essentially analog to digital boxes, controls and things. So he developed a little box that you could hitch up to a computer, a home computer, and then to some apparatus, and make it automate the apparatus, automate the scientific experiment. And this was still running, the first box he made. He made several in hand wire. And then he decided, oh, seems to be a need for this thing, why not make a company? And he has started this little company. It's now 5 years, I think time flies. And his first product was, well, I'll be careful in my remarks, but another company bought it out from him and is still on the market. In fact, it's now switched over to Honeywell, apparently. They're announcing this thing as if it was new. Apparently, it's exactly the same thing. But, okay, that was the first product. And they went to the other company for a prize. And then Stephen decided that he would try to get into the use of personal computers and process control work. And so he's got a real company now. He was able to get financing. He first got one man who financed his previous earlier operation, and this man is still involved in the thing. But now there's a whole group of venture capitalists, 5 or 6 of them, and they have put quite a lot of money into Kenneth's company.
Mm-hmm. What's the company called?
Data Acquisition Systems Incorporated.
Okay, I've seen their literature. I haven't bought anything from them, but I know about it. I want to skip from your family and back to your scientific career. Paradoxically, the tape got very noisy at the point where you were talking about 1/F noise and Stark modulation. So let's clarify that a little bit. Could you? I particularly missed what you had to say about observing the spectrum of ammonia and the vast signal noise improvement you saw.
Well, of course, the reason why it was better, I didn't know at the time, was because the 1/F noise was the limiting noise. And when you were modulating by Stark modulation, actually at 100 kilocycles. So we switched from practically zero in the ordinary non-modulated system, just the sweep frequency, to 100 kilocycles, and that made quite a bit of difference in 1/F noise, of course. As I say, I didn't know about that at that time, but we were doing it because it seemed a good idea. I guess the primitive notion to modulate, you throw out stuff that doesn't dissociate with the modulation. And of course it does that too. And it was very striking, the improvement in the signal of noise. It's great, many, certainly various number of powers of 10.
Hughes also, he published a paper on a an electrical secular determinant solver.
That's right. Well, let's forget about that.
I didn't want to forget about it. You had it hanging on the rack, I think, in your lab when I was in school here. It didn't work well, or
it worked. But it's an analog device. You don't build analog machines anymore, usually.
Well, that was...
Sometimes, but... you know, it was too much trouble to change the parameters and so on.
This was a set of pots and resistors, or was it, or what?
Yeah, it was a set of... the electrical... this was copied after an earlier mechanical thing that we built.
Okay, that...
the mechanical thing was sort of pendulum and springs. It was strictly analog.
Did you publish on the mechanical one? I seem to recall it.
I don't think I was able to
find it in the publication list.
I don't think you did. You built one that worked pretty well. It was sort of a nuisance to use. That isn't worth spending the time on.
These devices, are they no longer around?
No.
They would... okay, now, let's see. I missed also part of what you were saying about the infrared intensity measurement work with Judd Wells. Could you describe that somewhat more?
That was something... rather simple-minded, but I like it. Judd made it work. The problem of measuring infrared intensity, as you well know, is difficult, and you don't have a simple... Well, the main difficulty is that in a typical situation, you have a series of rotational transitions and spectral lines, and you shine light through the gas. This is gas is speaking about. You're measuring most in ordinary circumstances. You're measuring how much space there is between the lines, rather than the absorption of the lines themselves. And we put together, various people knew various things about this, and what we did is put together the different things that make one system, really, that if you extrapolate the zero length, the absorption length, for example, you can, or if you get infinite very high resolution, that helps you too, you can beat this problem of making a measurement of the absorption of individual lines when there's great big spaces next to them, most of the energy is going through the spaces. Anyway, this scheme we have does in principle beat that by extrapolation. And as I say, Judd Wells tried it out and worked fine, made it work. And it is in use. Still, I do believe. But nowadays, of course, it's not going to stay in use very much longer because as the laser infrared stuff becomes more convenient, cheaper, that's the only way people are going to do things. And with that resolution, use high resolution, you should change the system, the emphasis at least, of how you do this.
Okay. Now, you said a little bit about Bryce Crawford, and we didn't get much on that. You did work together with Bryce when he came here, didn't you?
Definitely. We had a group that consisted of Bryce and Fred Stitt, who both had NRC fellowships, I believe. Jack Linnet, who came from Oxford to work with Kistiakovsky, who passed him on to me. Harold Ashinowitz, guess I became the director of, became the director of research at Shell. And various times, of course, Judd Wells, Jack Howard. It was a fantastic collection.
You consider your paper with Crawford on the secular equation for molecular vibrations to be
I don't remember what that one wasn't the most important one, I'm afraid. I'd have to look and see where I got these things. I don't remember which one that one was. We did work on it. That's the kind of thing Bryce is working on. And I'd rather mention the work which we did together. Actually, we finished it up in a hotel room in New York at some meeting, which was, let me look at it in the listing here, get the name of it. Occasion 21. I'm, there are a lot of different forms.
There was a secular equation for molecular vibrations with Crawford in Journal Chemical Physics in 1938.
That's right. That's the one I'm looking at now. I don't believe that was a particularly important paper. I'm just refresh my memory. Which one? Unless we are. No. See that? There is paper on the mechanical analyzer, but don't forget it. It's not.
Well, let's not.
Look, skip that one. I think that was not. It was all right.
Okay, I just.
But what was a nice one with Bryce Crawford was handling of internal rotation and vibration. That's what I was trying to get my hands on here.
Now, let's see.
The FG business at that time, the method of obtaining the expanded secular equation. No, that's another scheme.
Well, let's go at it this way. I wanted to come back. First, I wanted to ask you about your books.
Excuse me, I found the...
Oh, fine.
The paper that I wanted to mention about with Crawford was the normal vibrations of molecules with internal torsional motions. That was General Chemical Physics, Volume 9, 1941. I think that was a useful paper. And Bryce, as I say, Bryce and I wrote that in a hotel room in New York one night. We've been thinking about it a lot, of course. And I think that, I don't know who did which, but I would say this is a paper in which Bryce and myself both have real contributions to it, not just...
All right. We'll come back shortly to some specific papers, but I wanted to ask you about how many copies of the Pauling and Wilson quantum chemistry book were sold. Do you recall?
Never found out. At some earlier point, we used to know the numbers, but
it had a large circulation.
It certainly had a large circulation. It's still in print, you know. McGraw-Hill has an Oriental edition or a Japanese or something printed. But now Dover Publications has taken it over here. And I don't know how many they're selling if they don't send me circulation figures.
How about the Introduction to Scientific Research? Is it widely
disseminated? That was quite widely, not in the same degree as the quantum mechanics, but that was, that still is in print. It's a paperback. McGraw-Hill discontinued the hardcover edition, but they do publish even in print as a
And how about the book on molecular vibrations with Theseus and Cross?
That had quite, again, not famous quantum mechanics,
yes,
a textbook at all, but it had a, it's been quoted and cited in citations tremendously. Dudley has some kind of a story about some kind of time curve on the number of papers in the field and how it broke and shot up when this book came out. I don't know.
Well, this book, was this book, was there something new in it, or was it just putting together pretty much what had been
pretty much
published
putting
in
together
papers before?
I think most of the material in there I had published before. I had actually written the book before the war. But that, when the Aztec time flies, and hadn't made, and that's Jack Theseus really wrote the new, the published version.
Was he one of your graduate students?
He had been a graduate student. And then went to Woods Hole with us, and back to Brown. And yes, he was. Had been a graduate student.
Yes.
Jack was very, very able.
How about your most cited papers?
The most cited ones, undoubtedly the book. They don't count that. But the papers, on which the two papers on the FG method, they've been cited apparently a very large number of times, and with the result that, as I told you, that the one of these journals has put it in there, selected it for monthly or something like that.
Yes, it's the Scientific Information Journal, and some title, Citation Index or such, something like that. I know the journal.
Right.
Well, we started just be trying to summarize what you thought were your most significant scientific contributions. We didn't get through this systematically.
You know, you can catalog, you can classify things according to different kinds of importance. One of them is, do other people use it? So how's the time going? What time is your practice?
I have 15 minutes.
Oh.
We can,
before the taxi comes?
Continue along with your remarks about your most important contributions, and I'll start picking up while you go.
Okay. All right, well, I think the FG method has been most quoted. The Stark effect microwave spectrometer is certainly, in a sense, been widely used. On the other hand, I have to say, if I hadn't, Huseman hadn't done it, somebody else would have very quick soon. And in fact, some other people did. They just didn't push it, didn't do anything about it, the Westinghouse people. But still, that's what people use today, mostly. Although not quite exclusively. The intensity in the infrared was I think we did a paper on intensities in the microwave, not as useful as the, not as good as the intensities in the infrared, and that was important because it was more obvious. We pushed a lot for double resonance of various kinds in the microwave business, and I'm still pushing for double resonance. I think it's a great thing, and the students did a lot of the theory that was needed to get the most out of the microwave spectra. And remember John Bragg worked on the quadrupole, nuclear quadrupole interaction. And Sid Golden worked on the dipole moment determination. And
what the paper on spark effect with asymmetric odors.
Well, that was the one with Howard. You mean the basic? I think so.
On the microwave.
Well, on the dipole moment. That termination dipole moment. Well, what he got was the effect of an electric field on the spectrum, that's right. Well, that was an important, that's been quoted a great deal, and it's used a great deal. All these things, after a while, they look sort of evident. You want to say that's obvious. Well, it wasn't obvious back then, what I would say was that at this point, in these effects like the quadrupole and the electric field and centrifugal distortion and a number of other things, owe a tremendous amount to the students who often took the lead. Now, internal rotation is a good example. Because Dudley Hitchcock wrote the definitive work on that. We've been playing around with it in various ways, as you know very well. It's customary nowadays to get up and say how much you owe your graduate students, but I think we're all in the same boat to varying degrees. But when you look at what has happened to my former graduate students, how could one fail not to be responsible for tremendous good work when you have students like that to do it?
Did you anticipate that Dudley Hirschbach was going to win a Nobel Prize?
No. I knew he was just about the best student I'd had. I knew that all right. He was, as a student, terrific. You know. Well, I'm getting nervous because I don't want you to miss your cab. And
well, I think we have done as well as we can.
I think
it's been a delightful interview.